Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
It is Suzanne Hill with you. Well, look, in these modern times, if you've got the need to be seen and importantly the means, your choices are endless. You could probably start on Instagram, or you could rent a villa over Christmas in Byron Bay, the Gold Coast, Rottnest Island. Perhaps you could taunt the rows of paparazzi lining Bondi Beach, or just turn up in the member stand at your nearest racing carnival. But in 19th century London, if you really wanted to flaunt it, you had to do it on horseback. Each week, Hyde Park, somewhat ironically named Rotten Row, became anything but. The most wealthy and good-looking all converged on the strip. They were decked out in their finest. They were riding the shiniest and most expensive horses around. And if, like most of the population, you didn't have those means, then all you could do was watch on as the hoity-toity mingled, flirted and dazzled. That is, unless you happen to offer a certain set of age-old skills for a price and an ability to turn heads and drop jaws wherever you rode. Those young seductresses became known as the pretty horsebreakers. Their tales remained the stuff of legend. And we're going to learn about them tonight with Miriam Bibby, who is an equine historian, archaeologist and writer, and joins us now from Dumfries and Galloway in southwest Scotland. Hi, Miriam. Welcome to Nightlife.
Hello, Suzanne. It's lovely to be here and across the world and across the time zones as well.
Yeah. Now, paint us a picture of Rotten Row in Hyde Park during one of these high-class soirees.
Well, Hyde Park is one of the royal parks of London, and it's a massive open space in London that everyone will know. So it's automatically a magnet for people to gather in, for rest and relaxation, and as you rightly say, in the 19th century, for seeing, being seen and flirting. The 1860s really were the high days of the pretty horsebreakers, and by that time, Rotten Row was well established as a place for riding. It had been put in by William III, King William. There's a carriage track originally between Kensington and Westminster, but and nowadays, I think this is still the rule, actually, only the monarch may drive a horse-drawn vehicle along Rotten Row. Everybody else has to ride. So there were various elements that came together, really, to make Rotten Row, both Hyde Park and Rotten Row, this important gathering place for equestrians. Mm. The first one was the facilities. It's a big park with lots of rides and drives in it. The other parks didn't really compare with Hyde Park for those facilities. It was also made popular by Queen Victoria, who rode in Rotten Row. So obviously what the king or queen is doing is a massive draw for people. They want to do the same thing. It had also been used as a place for military gatherings and musters. So you've also got the element of soldiery and the massive monument to the Duke of Wellington, which was in the form of a very controversial statue of Achilles, fully naked, standing in the middle of Hyde Park. And this became a very controversial gathering point for people as well. And eventually there was so much discussion about it that they had to put a fig leaf on to cover Achilles.
So thinking the Victorians were not fond of seeing male genitalia on statues, were they?
No, exactly. But as you can imagine, it was quite a magnet for people. And you can imagine some of the unsavoury jokes that may have gone on around the statue.
Yeah. And so, Miriam, why did they call it Rotten Row? Where did that name come from?
There's various suggestions for this. The first one is that it's just a London corruption of Route de Roi, the King's Way. The second one is that it's from a German word, Rotteren, which is a word for a place where troops gather. And the third one is simply that it relates to the soft surface of the track. It's like rotten, dark material, and it's soft to ride on. And also, I imagine, soft to fall on, because I'm sure some equestrians fell off from time to time.
And so was it about just sort of flaunting your wealth, or was there actually quite a serious aspect where people came? I mean, I'm sort of thinking of the scenes we see in the TV show Bridgerton. People came actually to sort of flirt and meet partners.
They certainly did. And it was extraordinarily influential in terms of what people wore, what people thought, how they behaved. The behaviour that you saw in Rotten Row in Hyde Park was very influential on society generally. This is the important aspect. So you'd think that sort of equestrianism and riding were elite pursuits, and to a certain extent, I suppose, they were. But all sorts of people in society in the 19th century needed to ride, sometimes for business or other activities. This kind of riding, that developed specifically for Rotten Row and Hyde Park, was called park riding, and it required a certain set of skills, a certain type of horse, and a certain way of dressing. The horses were usually called park hacks, and they were the kind of horses that very refined people, the aristocrats, would ride. Arabs were very popular for Arab horses for women to ride in the 19th century. But it's interesting that something happened, a sort of democratization of riding in Rotten Row gradually as the decades passed. And certainly by the 20th century, it became a place where anybody could go riding and just enjoy themselves. And I actually believe that the pretty horse breakers were influential on that development, because by the 1870s, there are people saying things like, it's not just confined, these are equestrian authors, they're saying it's not just confined to, quote, those only whose names figure in the pedigrees of Burke or Debrett, but also the wives and daughters of professional men and tradesmen. So there's another aspect to this at this particular time, which is that being able to ride was an extremely good asset for any woman who would be married to a colonial, an empire administrator, or someone who was in the army. That was a massive asset if you could do that. So you see this kind of process going on whereby suddenly it's not just for the aristocracy, it's also for people from different backgrounds as well.
Yeah. You had to be wealthy, you had to be good looking, but you're talking about these skills of being able to ride a horse. Was that sort of one of the prerequisites also for getting out and riding in the park? And what sort of skills did you have to have?
Yes, it was not just a question of being able to ride a horse, but to look good on a horse, to combine fashion, appearance with your riding skills. So these two were very important. And these would be the things that would launch the pretty horse breakers to superstardom, celebrity, really, in the 1860s and 70s. You look the part, and an interesting thing about women's fashion is that it's always in equestrianism, it's always tended to follow male fashion. So back in the days of Charles II, you'd get cavalier, the wives and families of cavaliers dressing in similar fashion to the men folk. In the 18th century, you get the classic tricorn hat, and again, women adopting men's fashions. And the same was true of the type of fashion that was popular in the 1860s, which was the silk top hat, often decorated to be a bit more feminine with a veil or flowers, and the rather sober riding, very, very close-fitting riding dress that women wore. So you had to not only be able to ride, but to look good. Had to look the part as well. As a sort of an aside to this, is the type of people who rode in Rotten Row, and it was looking the part that got the pretty horse breakers access to the road, really. There was another Rotten Row on Hampstead Heath, which was a much rougher affair, where it was a sort of a copycat of what was happening in the elite Rotten Row, but with people who were definitely not so wealthy and not so bothered about how they were turned out. So that's just an interesting thing there. I see how Rotten Row at this point, during the season in summer, any day of the week, you could find the row crowded with riders. It's like a moving fashion parade, really. Or you could call it, I suppose, a form of speed dating on horseback. Charles II, again, we owe a lot to this to him. The Stuarts had a thing called riding in the ring, which was a ring in Hyde Park, and you rode round and round in your coach, bowing and waving to everybody as you passed one another. So it's kind of a way to meet quickly on the hoof, you know. And basically, I guess, a moving gossip column you can imagine if they'd had a commentator there in those days, they'd have been picking out the celebrities. And, you know, and here comes Catherine Walters Skittles with her latest catch, Lord Hartington, escorting her along the road kind of thing. It's very much a moving gossip column, really.
Well, Miriam Bibby is with you, equine historian, archaeologist and writer, and she's telling us all about, well, Rotten Road, this place to go riding in Hyde Park in London in the 1800s. And we're just going to really start now hearing about the pretty horse breakers who were really courtesans on horseback. So who were these women, firstly, and how did they come to start riding in Rotten Row?
It's very interesting because when you look at their biographies, their backgrounds, you see that there are certain common features to them. They were all either working class or, I mean, with this kind of hair splitting of status, of social status and class, that this all was the case in Britain. You'd call them all either upper working class or lower middle class, I think. They weren't from the bottom of the stack, certainly. They were, for instance, Catherine Walters' father, Skittles' father, he was what was called a tide waiter, which is a sort of a member of the customs organisation. He would go aboard ships and check the goods that were on ships. We have another one, Laura Bell, who was from Ireland. Her father was a bailiff. And a third, the very famous pretty horsebreaker, who was better known in France, Cora Pearl. Her father was actually a music teacher and wrote songs. So a lot of them come from a very specific class, which is not straight off the streets, is moderately well off, but certainly not wealthy. This is a recurring thing with them.
So what was the idea? I mean, you would come down to Rotten Row. I guess you needed to know that you had the looks and the riding skills if you were going to try there, that this was a place that you only went if you really knew you had what it took to stand out and catch someone's eye.
This is the great thing about the pretty horsebreakers. They were all superb horse riders. This comes over again and again and again in their biographies. You can see that they really knew how to ride. This gave them access to this elite world, largely because they could work for livery yard owners who could see the value of a really good rider, a woman on horseback, to display the horses that they wanted to sell or hire. So it's very interesting that you have these very well-dressed women who pass in terms of how they look with the women of the aristocracy or gentry, and they're marketing horses to other women. That's what they're doing. So we might use the analogy of car sales, really, but in this case, the women are selling the means of transport and display to other women.
So they're the models for the horses, basically.
They are. That's exactly what they're doing, yeah. But they certainly had superb skills, and this meant that livery yard owners who perhaps had an awkward horse to sell could give it to one of these riders to ride. They would make it look wonderful as they were riding along Rotten Row. Women would look at it and go, I want that horse. I want to be that person. I want to look like that. And then by the time, presumably, Skittles or whoever got back to the livery yard, he'd say, well done, lass. I've had four offers for that horse since you've been out. Here's your commission, you know. But very often the horses turned out not to be so easy to ride if you didn't have the level of skills that these people did.
The women. And for the women, would you go, you know, you'd arrive in London, you go rock up at the livery yard and basically say, well, look, here I am. Take a look at me. I can ride. Shall I go ride your horses for you?
This seems to have been the case, certainly with some of them, with Catherine Walters and Laura Bell, who was about 10 years older than Catherine, seems to have set the scene a decade earlier. We do know one thing, that they genuinely had a love of horse riding, that this was something that felt very natural to them and that they wanted to be involved in. And while they may have been involved in other aspects of, what shall we say, I guess the London sex trade at that time, prior to becoming involved with the livery yards, this was a means of doing something different, taking a step in a different direction that would bring you into contact with some very wealthy and influential people indeed. Yes.
We are learning about the pretty horse breakers on Nightlife tonight. Now, Miriam, perhaps the most well-documented of them was a young woman who was named Catherine Walters. She had the nickname Skittles. Why was she called Skittles? I think there are a few different theories, aren't there?
There are a few different theories. One is that she used to work setting up the Skittles in a Skittle bowling alley. And this was where she got her nickname of Skittles, or to the people that she was mostly intimate with, she was known as Skitsy. And another is that on one occasion when there was a brawl going on, perhaps in a public house, she said she was going to start knocking everybody about like bloody Skittles if they didn't behave themselves, kind of thing. She was a very earthy character who, I think it's good to say, never really forgot her background. She never really forgot where she came from. She didn't lose her Liverpool accent. She, even when she reached the heights of fame, she kept that earthiness and contact. And this is what's made her something of a legend, really, to people.
Yeah. And what were the attributes that made her such a great asset, I guess, for the delivery companies and on Rotten Row? What were all those things that she brought with her to Rotten Row?
The riding skills were immensely important. There are various ways that she said, again, this is all legendary, really. They say that she may have ridden with the Tarpley Hunt in Cheshire. She did love hunting. She went hunting consistently all through her life. It was a big activity for her and elite women. And it's possible, but we don't really know. This is just a theory. These skills were outstanding. There's a writer called R.S. Surtees who wrote about hunting life, and he invented a wonderful character called Lucy Glitters, who is said to be based on Catherine Walters. And Lucy is also a superb equestrian who can ride any horse, and she's kind of very valuable asset to a chap called Facey Rumford, who has a pack of hounds. And he uses her to show off a very difficult horse called Leotard. It's a sort of running joke that only Lucy can ride Leotard, who is kind of very popular because he plausibly looks like an Arabian horse. We don't even know if he is. But once the horse has been sold on, nobody else can ride him and he keeps coming back. So he could be bought back at a lower price. Lucy can ride him again. And then he'll be sold on to the next person who comes along thinking, I want to look like that. And this is, I think, shows how influential these people were. It was less a case of copying what the aristocracy were doing than actually having an immense influence on fashions and modes and how people behave. They were great influencers. I think that's a good word to use often.
Now, I was Miriam, I was just reading as I was preparing for this that there were some cases where the mothers of the eligible young women of the aristocracy, who of course needed to go to their marriages as virgins, were pretty cranky about these pretty horse breakers because they certainly grabbed a lot of male attention, didn't they, which their mothers thought should have been directed at their daughters.
Totally. And the best example of this is with Lord Hartington, Harty Tarty was his nickname, who was the heir of the Devonshire dukedom. And Skittles, she started right at the top. She managed to hook him, basically. This was the start of her career as a serious career as a courtesan. And of course, one of her biographies makes the interesting point that she was born in a terrace in Liverpool and the Devonshire estate is just, Chatsworth House is just 60 miles away, but you couldn't have got a more different upbringing than these two people. And of course, as it was a similar situation in France with the people that were called the demi-monde, the people that were kind of the women who were courtesans and drew men away from the eligible women. There was quite a parallel there, really, between the two things. It caused a great furore, really. And Skittles was involved with several people in that way who would have, it would have caused great anxiety and anger amongst mothers who were looking for eligible partners for their daughters.
Yeah. So would the idea be then to sort of basically snag yourself a the fellow who you would have a relationship with, you'd become his lover, and then he would pay your way?
That's how it was. Catherine was slightly different because she always seems to have maintained a kind of independence. I don't think she ever took this as seriously as others did. She always had a good sense of humour and was earthy about it and seems to have valued friendship. You know, she remained friends with a lot of her lovers, including Wilfred Blunt, who seems to have been profoundly influenced by his very brief relationship with her. But for a lot of women, there's another famous courtesan called Cora Pearl. Yes, it was a very serious way to wealth and extraordinary wealth and success. 60 horses, fabulous jewels, everything that, you know, if you measure success in that way, this would bring you everything you wanted. And for Cora Pearl, that was success.
Yeah. So did some of these women ever actually marry into the aristocracy?
Yes, they did eventually. In fact, Catherine's younger sister, married into the French aristocracy, but I don't think she'd been a courtesan as Catherine had been. I know less about her, to be perfectly honest. But yes, so it could happen. It was rare, but it was not unknown, and it did cause an awful lot of family issues within families when it happened. It certainly didn't happen with Lord Hartington, Harty Tarty. He married, I think it was the Duchess of Manchester, Lottie. So it was definitely not going to happen with him. That was broken up fairly quickly. Yeah.
So to follow the course of Catherine Walter's Skittles, so she moved to Paris, didn't she, a bit later?
She did. And there it was after a bit of a scandal. The only sort of big scandal of her life, where she was involved with a married man and it led to a major divorce case in America. And that really was the big scandal of her life. She wasn't sort of one of these people who's always going from kind of scandal seeking celebrity. She's, in terms of others, her life was reasonably low key, you know, comparably. But she went to Paris. She became the lover of a rich French banker and was a great rival to Cora Pearl. I think the two saw each other as rivals, but they were very, very different characters. But it's sort of coming from the same kind of background, one daughter of a music teacher, you know, again, lower middle class, one Catherine being the daughter of a customs man. So I guess they could sort of see the similarities in one another and perhaps were rivals over men sometimes as well. But it was in Paris that Catherine met Wilfred Blunt, and he had this really profound effect on him. They remained friends right throughout her life. And when she came to the end of her life, it was he who arranged a funeral for her. There is something that must be said. Wilfred Blunt was a very complex and difficult and all tyrannical man within his own family later in life. His daughter, Judith Blunt, Lady Wentworth, blamed him and blamed Skittles entirely for the way he behaved to other women, and particularly her and her mother. I'm not sure if that's entirely fair, because he managed to maintain a very good friendship with Skittles. And, you know, she may have been being a bit unjust in blaming him for that. I'm not saying that his behaviour was good. It was tyrannical towards them. But I don't think Catherine Walters was to blame for it.
Now, she's still remembered as a bit of a folk hero. Is this right that there's a plaque dedicated to her memory in London?
There is, yes. Yes, she is. And I think it is fair to say that she's a bit of a folk hero. And I think the reason for that is that coming from working class, lower middle class background, others of similar situation can find something to admire in people who manage to make it despite all the odds being against them. They kind of think, well, good for you, you know, good on you. You've you've made something of your life. You've made something that we can see. Same goes for men. It was very often sporting achievements, obviously boxing, football, that kind of thing. The opportunities for women were much less. And that was one of the ways you could do it, was by living in that world and being a lover to rich and wealthy men. But with Catherine, I think there was always something that was just apart from that. I think she genuinely loved horses and horse riding. And perhaps it was, you know, as much the access to that kind of aspect of the world and fashion that she enjoyed, because she rode through her life for as long as she could. And she actually took up roller skating at one point, believe it or not, when it was fashionable to do so.
Gosh, when did roller skating begin?
That would be latter years of the 19th century.
Oh, wow.
And I was quite interested in that because my own grandparents met at a roller skating rink in Sunderland in the early years of the 20th century. So that sounds, it sounds like roller skating became another place where you go and see and be seen and flirt with people. Yes.
While going round and round in a circle, it seems to be the tradition. Yes. Yeah.
Yes, you're quite right. It's kind of a similarity, isn't it? It's been, the dating on the move, you know, yeah. Speed dating, yeah.
So where's that plaque, just in case, you know, anyone's heading to London soon and thinking, oh, I think I'd like to go see that.
Oh, my gosh, I should definitely know this, but I don't just have the details.
Don't worry, we can look that up, yeah.
Yes, if you can, yeah, that would be great.
So how long did this era of the pretty horse breakers last? What sort of brought it to a close?
It's seen really as being the 1860s and 70s, the same as in France, really, you know, the golden age, the gilded age. What I think it's interesting what brought it to an end, that may have been that all sorts of activities such as horse riding and maybe even the activities of the pretty horse breakers themselves made other women want to do that, want to be involved in that. If you think about it, if you were a wealthy woman from an aristocratic background, you may have the wealth, you may have the contacts, you may have everything else, but you don't have the freedom of these women who can ride in Hyde Park alone and they just get away with it, as they say. So there's an increasing thing that aristocratic women, rather than the pretty horsebreakers copying aristocratic women, aristocratic women are copying their pretty horsebreakers. We want to do this as well. The prime example of this would be the Empress of Austria, Elizabeth Sisi, who also took part in hunting and hunted with the same hunts, actually, as Catherine Walters did. They want some of this freedom that the women have. So I think there was a change in the whole attitude to things. Plus, of course, the car was coming in. The car became the way to show yourself off. But as late as the 1930s, some people were complaining that if you went to Rotten Row in Hyde Park, my goodness, you'd see Gibson girls riding there, actresses, and they were sort of comparing them with the pretty horse breakers of the olden days. What are these women doing in riding in Rotten Row, you know?
Oh, what if
so it's kind of faded out
rather than ended with a bang. Miriam Bibby is here, an equine historian, archaeologist and writer. Interesting SMS from Sam, who says, how interesting. This is very much the basis of the 1900 development of the tan track around the Botanic Gardens in Melbourne. Not sure about the courtesans, but given the history of this part, I wouldn't be surprised. And Sam says that area was also nicknamed Rotten Row sometime later. Ooh, might be worth a bit of investigation into that one.
Certainly, yes.
Yeah. Now, Miriam, before I let you go, I am fascinated by your job as an equine historian. Did you get into that because you have a relationship with horses yourself?
Yes, I've kept horses for a very long time. And basically, I've always been interested in the history of the horse. Because we owe horses so much, we owe them everything, really. We wouldn't be where we are without horses. And we've had a relationship with domesticated horses for getting on for 6,000 years now. Now that we've got cars and machines and so forth, it's easy to forget just how much we owe them. So my interest has always been in horses and history started out, I suppose, as separate interests, and then obviously they began to merge together. And it's a really big part of me, who I am and what I do. Anything horsey and history will immediately grab my attention. And luckily, I'm lucky to work in a community of scholars and academics that is growing worldwide. We have various organisations now, such as the Equine History Collective. We're all out to show one thing, and that is how important horses are. Horses are an important part of history that needs to be recognised. Yeah,
yeah. I was listening to a history podcast recently. I can't remember what they were the exact era, but it was someone was saying, look, this was the first time that people were using horses in battle, in warfare, and just to really let that sink in, that, you know, you'd always had people on foot marching, and suddenly when you had horses in battle, everything changed.
It did, and this changed really in very ancient times. I guess the Bronze Age was the period, what we call the Bronze Age, was the period when you suddenly see horses and chariots being adopted in warfare. The prime example would be, and this is one of my own interests, is Egyptian horses and chariots. So, yes, it changed the warfare situation beyond belief, really. People, of course, that called it an arms race and, you know, comparable to the development of nuclear weapons and so forth. You were so much more mobile. You could get around a battlefield very quickly. You could look very imposing. Think of the Egyptian pharaohs. And with the bow, a composite bow, very cleverly made of various materials, you could shoot people from a very great distance. And then, of course, you get the development of cavalry and so on, which is another form of equine-based warfare, yes.
Yeah. So, Miriam, is the day of horses having a significant influence on history over?
What a good question. I think that's a very good question. It's so hard to assess at the moment. In the 20th century, people were saying very gloomily that horses were on their way out. It was all over for them. We're developing a relationship with horses in new ways. There are things like equine therapy, where people just relate to horses simply for being horses rather than wanting to ride them or drive them or make use of them in some form. But I think it's fair to say that all over the world, semi-feral horses, herds of horses that have lived in a relationship with human beings for many millennia, thousands of years, are under threat. They're under threat for the same reasons that wild animals are, which is simply, people wanting the space to do something else or feeling that they're damaging the environment and so on. It's complicated, but the main thing I think to say is that we do still have a relationship with horses. It's changed over the years. They have been very influential upon us. We have been influential upon them and the way that they look, their characters and habits. It's still going on. It's not over. The way that we used to relate to them has changed, but I think that the relationship continues, thankfully. We owe them a lot, basically.
Miriam, thank you so much for joining us on Nightlife and telling us all about these pretty horse breakers and giving us into a glimpse into that world. Speed dating on horse, I love the way you described it, which you can't do in a car, can you?
No, it's just not the same, is it? It doesn't have the same romance at all.
No, and you can't really see what you're wearing in the car. All your skills, driving skills. So look, yeah. All right. Hey, thank you so much, Miriam. Really great to speak with you.
Oh, it's been lovely. Thank you. Thanks, Suzanne, and all the best to all you listeners.
That is Miriam Bibby, who is an equine historian, archaeologist and writer, telling you all about the world of the pretty horse breakers. So if you happen to be visiting London anytime soon in Hyde Park, you might sort of close your eyes and try to imagine those same scenes that she was telling us about taking place.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.